Welcome to the Reboot Republic podcast, the podcast that goes behind the headlines in this republic of inequality, looks at the big issues, and most importantly, looks at the solutions. We are the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and joined, as always, by my co-host and alter ego, Tony Groves. Tony, how are you? It's been a while since we've actually done a podcast.
Yeah, no, we've been doing them intermittently, but more important, the last time I think we were actually face-to-face was out in Maynooth for the housing conference. It's been a long time. This lockdown has been, it's been societally changing, but I'm hoping that I keep hearing things, people talk about getting back to normal, and that worries me, because when we launched Reboot Republic, you launched on the basis of about actually doing things differently, and the idea of going back to where we were in February when we're at a housing conference talking about, you know, communities, minorities, people with disabilities, housing for travellers, housing needs for just general people, and now we're talking about getting back to normal. So I don't want so much to go back to normal as to get back to better. That's my rant out of the way.
Yeah, no, I think that, like, for, you know, personally, it's been a, you know, it's been an incredible time to try and adjust with, you know, particularly with young children. I know there's a lot of people with a lot of different issues that have struggled in the lockdown. And, you know, into the future, the normal, like, what is the normal, kids going back to school or not, and childcare and everything. And I'm delighted, I have to say, I've got another 2 years in Maynooth, which is a relief, a big relief to get that. And another reduced stress for a year or so anyway, before we get worried again. But I think that it's a difficult time, and a time that we actually need a bit of hope and a bit of reflection on what is the normal and what is the change we want to go back to. And on that, we're delighted today to be joined by Tricia Keelty, from the Head of Social Justice and Policy at St. Vincent de Paul. Tricia, it's great to have you with us.
Hiya, thanks for having me on.
We're going to talk today about a report that the St. Vincent de Paul just published last week called The Hidden Cost of Poverty, Estimating the Public Service Cost of Poverty in Ireland, which was written by Dr. Micheál Collins, and a really interesting report, and there's a lot in it. But before we get onto that, I just wanted to kind of get your assessment of the programme for government we saw released there, and just the kind of sense of poverty, because there has been I haven't had a chance to go through it in detail, but the kind of sense generally is that from kind of those engaged in policy and around concern to poverty and inequality, is that it didn't really, is not an ambitious document around kind of reducing, radically ending poverty. It doesn't even mention child poverty. What's your kind of sense of it?
Yeah, I suppose the main reference to poverty in the draft document is that it will seek to implement the roadmap for social inclusion. Now, that was published in February, 2 days before the general election was called. So I suppose people may not be very familiar with what was contained in that document, but that does include targets around reducing consistent poverty. It also contains a commitment to develop a new target for child poverty. So it is, child poverty is mentioned, but not directly in the programme for government document. So it may slip down the priority if it's not specifically named in the programme for government. So that would be something we'd be concerned about. But if the roadmap for social inclusion was properly implemented, we would see some reduction in poverty. But I suppose at the moment, there's so much economic uncertainty. We would have expected greater emphasis on the issue, as we may be facing into a period where poverty may increase because people may not be able to go back to work as a result of COVID. And people may be struggling more with household bills, different costs as well. So I would have expected to see maybe a greater emphasis on it, maybe ambitious targets around it. And we wouldn't have been very, the targets that are contained in the roadmap for social inclusion do state that they want to reduce consistent poverty to 2% or less by 2025. And that's something we would support. But some of the other targets aren't really ambitious enough given the scale of poverty, because we know that almost 700,000 people are living in poverty in Ireland. So it is a persistent issue. It's an issue that hasn't been tackled by successive governments. So it's time now, and especially in the context of this report that we've published, which shows that tackling poverty is not just a benefit to those that are experiencing it, but it's a benefit for everybody in society.
Yeah, and I was quite struck by that in the report, the figures showing the actual, as you say, there's 700,000 people in poverty. And even I was looking like at the height of the crisis, you know, went up to maybe 850,000. But all the way through from 2008, every year from over since then, like the number of children in poverty has been more or less the same. There's been no real change between 200,000 to 250,000. Like they are staggering numbers. And I know you were proposing before the election the idea of a poverty act. Was that right?
That's something that we're still advocating for. And that is something that can be introduced regardless of what is said in the programme for government, because it will be a piece of legislation that would make those targets legally binding. So just like our climate action targets would be legally binding, we'd like to see that the poverty reduction targets are legally binding. So it holds governments to account that it's high on the national agenda. And I suppose one of the first jobs for the government that we'd like to see is that they set up a special joint Oireachtas committee on poverty and inequality, because it's an issue that has been around for so many years. We haven't really got to grips with it, and it hasn't really been examined at the level that it needs to be and discussed, and what are the measures that are needed to address it, who are the groups most at risk, and what supports are needed. Because I think without that, then you're not really going to get the action that's needed, because at budget time, other priorities take preference, and it's something that tends to slip down the agenda. I suppose if we saw that in the last recession, when the people who were least likely able to take the brunt of the cuts were hit hardest by that. And we just don't want a repeat of that. So if you had a piece of legislation that had those safeguards for people, then we would be in a much better position if we are facing into a difficult economic period.
Just come in on that, because I know part of the programme for government that the Greens have successfully gotten, you know, each department will have their carbon targets that they will have to get down. So it'll be specifically targeted, and it will be then, you know, there's a level of accountability because there's carbon budgeting going on as part of it. The problem, as I see it, and correct me, I'd like you to correct me if I'm wrong, is that the people who talk about inequality tend to be economists, and they will tell you that we're doing a reasonable job of actually reducing inequality based on the basis of that, you know, it's not gotten as bad as some other countries are, and also in when we do the social transfers, it lifts a large portion of people out, and it's from an economic standpoint, they don't measure deprivation as such. They measure the numbers that are actually below a certain threshold. Am I wrong there?
No, that would be correct. And I suppose our social protection system does a lot of the heavy lifting, because we have such an uneven distribution of market income. So before we take account of social welfare payments, child benefit, we have one of the highest rates of income inequality in the European Union. So our system has to work very hard to actually achieve what would be comparable moderate levels of inequality. But it still leaves a large proportion of our population living below the poverty line. And I think there is some limitations to some of the poverty measures that we have, because it really only looks at income. So we can't really compare income inequality or the standard of living for people in poverty here in Ireland when we have such poor provision of public services and such a high cost of living to a country like Sweden, which may have similar levels of income poverty, but people who are living in poverty have, they can access subsidised childcare, healthcare, affordable housing, and all those issues persist for people who live in poverty. And I think one of the most telling indicators is the inability to afford an unexpected expense. Because people have no disposable income in Ireland, because we have such a high level of low income, but also the cost of services is so high. And we've one of the highest rates of families and households with children who cannot afford an unexpected expense. So I think that tells you a lot about the difficulties people are facing in Ireland. And if we look at the position of people in poverty before the last economic shock and now, so before in 2008, 29% of people in poverty were going without basics, like suitable clothing and nutritious food. Now, 40% are going without those basics. So those people are more vulnerable. While the situation may have returned to pre-crisis levels for maybe the average population, for people on the lowest incomes, things are still a lot worse, and they're in a much vulnerable position if we are heading into another recession. So that's why we need to keep poverty and the need to address it at the top of the national agenda.
We move on to the report then, in terms of, because I think that's a quite an important point to make, and I think it is really unfortunate that poverty doesn't seem to have been given the priority it should have been given in the programme for government. And we do absolutely need to keep the focus on that and the ideas that you're putting across in the points. And I think that is really important. And I know the lockdown as well would have had a major impact on people in terms of reducing their capacity. But just the report then, I think, is really, really valuable. And in terms of, because myself and Tony and you have talked about this before, in terms of like this idea of, you know, the idea of even the cost of poverty. And what do you mean by that? And I was really struck by the report, you know, the figure between, you know, at a low end, possibly 3 billion, at a high end, 7 billion a year. And you went for the figure of 4.5 billion a year being spent on measures, not so much to eradicate poverty, but to deal with the consequences of poverty. And that this, like, it's obviously necessary money because it's keeping people with some sort of provision that is needed and responding to poverty, and it would be so much worse if it wasn't. But like, that is more than is going to be spent on the children's hospital. Well, we hope it'll probably run higher. But in terms of people getting their head, we're spending more than what will be spent on building the new children's hospital every year just to deal with the consequences of poverty. I think it's shocking, and it's really, I think it should be a wake-up call. What was your kind of sense from the report of the main kind of aspects that you thought are important that kind of people are worth kind of knowing and thinking about?
Yeah, I suppose it's difficult to estimate fully the cost of poverty, not least the scarring effects it has on individuals.
Yeah.
You know, we would see firsthand the impact living in poverty has on people, their mental health, their physical health, the stress and strain of having to deal with living day to day, week to week, not knowing what unexpected expense might be around the corner, and the long-term impact that has on parents and children and people with disabilities and older people as well can't be underestimated. So I think at the outset, we should, you know, our focus should be on the individual costs. But I suppose this report showed that it also triggers costs on the public purse. And the focus was on the way in which the state is dealing with the impact poverty has on people's lives and making up for the ways the poverty damages people's lives. So it's not looking at how it's tackling the poverty, but really just dealing with the symptoms of poverty. So budget expenditure is its Department of Health, because we know the link between poverty and having poor health outcomes, risk of poor illnesses, greater risk of having chronic illnesses or having a disability or dying earlier, and on all that poverty, the scarring effect that poverty leaves on people's lives. So 1.2 billion expenditure in the healthcare services dealing with the association between poverty and poor health outcomes. So that's a huge amount of money. And I think just to put some of the main figure in context, so the 4.5 billion is greater than the respective budgets for housing, justice, agriculture and transport. So that's a huge amount of money that's spent every year dealing with the consequence of poverty. And it's also, to put another way, one in every 20 euro collected in taxation is dealing with the problems caused by poverty as well. So it's a substantial figure. And I suppose it just shows the costs to everyone in society of allowing poverty to persist.
Yeah. And I was looking at some of the figures and I was quite struck by, if you look at the areas where the highest proportion of spending goes towards trying to address the poverty impacts, as you mentioned, health is one. The next one, of course, is housing. And of the total housing budget, 40% of it is going to address poverty. In the Garda expenditure on the guards, again, this is a shocking figure, that 40% of expenditure in relation to the guards goes on addressing poverty-related issues, and 40% of the courts as well. And you just go like, these is in housing courts, the guards, the dealing with the consequences of failing to address poverty costs so much in these areas.
Absolutely. It's staggering, really, I think. And it just also shows how it impacts so many areas of society, whether that is in terms of our health system, dealing with the legacy effects of child poverty as well, in terms of early disadvantage. Over 550 million is spent every year dealing with those legacy effects, and also spending now to help children who may be falling behind catch up as well. So if poverty were eliminated, those costs should disappear. And I suppose it's just at the outset, it's an inefficient use of public resources where it could be better spent. And I suppose, to be clear, to address poverty, we need increased upfront spending now so we can reduce expenditure in the future, dealing with the ways that poverty damages people's lives. But I think in the short term, we're going to need to spend more. And one of the key messages from the report is that we need to invest to save, because it's going to happen overnight. It is a challenge to address the issues that poverty causes, but it does bring to light the significant costs that are borne by the state in really just dealing with the symptoms of it rather than addressing the structural issues that cause it.
Yeah, I was really, really struck by that phrase. I was actually going to say it again, that idea, and I think we need to say it over and over, invest to save. That concept of actually spending now to then save money over the medium and long term. And again, housing, something that we have gone on a lot about. You know, the housing assistance payment is a really good example of that. The money that is poured into private landlords to house people because we haven't built social housing, the money been put into emergency accommodation hubs, like hundreds of millions every year that should actually be invested. And then you save that money over the longer term. I think that invest to save is really important. Sorry, Tony, you wanted to come in there.
No, I was literally interested in when we talk about this all the time, we always go back on the basis of financially the most incompetent way of doing things is always to treat it after it's happened, as opposed to prevention is better than cure, as we say. We your doctor told you that when you were a kid, that the ads used to be run on this, but where we're sitting there when we're talking about this, it just makes no sense from anybody's perspective. And we see it now with things in the US where they're talking about a huge movement to defund police, and people go, that sounds scary, what does that mean? They're going, well, actually what it means is having a social care worker knocking on the door as opposed to a policeman, because the money that goes from one area has to go to another one. And you know, we talk about community policing, we talk about all of these areas where people in disadvantaged communities, they're a bit more afraid of certain aspects of society or dealing with the state and how the state deals with them. And all of that comes down to poverty causing trauma, causing worse health outcomes. And these are life-limiting experiences. And, you know, Rory, we talk to people all the time about it, and we're effectively creating these issues. And in this program for government, I think one of the things that people have pushed back on within the Greens is the fact that housing policy is climate policy, climate policy is health policy, all of these. And you know, and like that, poverty has to be a metric that gets more. I just feel like I'm going on a rant here, but poverty as a metric doesn't get spoken about enough, you know?
I think.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Georgia. No, you go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to agree. It's obviously that we would think that it's not given the priority it needs. And I think it is just something that's maybe seen as something that affects other people, and it's not really has an impact on society. And I think it may feed into some of the narratives that persist around people not understanding the structural causes of poverty, or that there is a sense that people are to blame for their own circumstances. So it's trying to throw a light on the drivers of poverty, and also that the damage it causes to communities, to individuals, and to society as a whole as well. And that idea of prevention is better than cure is something as well that we want to bring to the fore.
And yeah, and I think it is, you know, it is important. And I imagine you, like you struggled a little bit or thought about in terms of even the phrasing of the cost of poverty is a challenging one, because of course, you know, poverty is not is a cost in the sense of it costs investment, it costs money, but we have to spend that. So it's a hard one in terms of, because you don't want people to go, oh, it's just a cost, therefore why are we paying it? It can have a negative connotation as well, and that people go, well, oh, it's costing us all this money, sure, they don't deserve it, why are we spending it? And it can feed into that narrative. Whereas what you're trying to very clearly say is that, well, actually, you know, it costs all of us. I think the figure was 900 euro per person per year is what it costs in just trying to deal with the consequence of poverty. And if we actually addressed poverty over the long term, then that would free up money to invest in other areas. So it would be more beneficial. And always struck and always brought back to in these conversations to the, you know, the work of Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett around the spirit level and the studies they have consistently done, you know, on countries with lower levels of inequality, lower levels of poverty, that the whole of society benefits if you reduce poverty and you reduce inequality. And I think as well that what, you know, what it really struck by as well in the document was that kind of the ways in which, for example, like the numbers, again, to come back to, because sometimes I think those numbers are really hard to get your head around. Like I was just trying to put, like, 225,000 children live in poverty. Like, what is their daily reality? Like, 200,000 children in this country live in poverty. And yet how much is it talked about?
It is a staggering number. And I suppose the lived reality of that probably isn't widely known. I think actually the No Child 2020 campaign actually was the first time many people maybe had thought about child poverty and the way that it impacts children's lives. And In a variety of ways, whether that is missing out on social activities with their friends because they don't have money to go on the school trip, or falling behind in school, or their physical health, the impact that has on them. And just also just parents, I suppose we published a study 2 years ago, actually. It was a qualitative piece of research that was carried out by the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice. It was 30 interviews with families who were living on an income that was inadequate to meet their basic needs. And yeah, most striking things to come out of that was just the level of guilt parents felt from how they know to their children, and feeling guilty that they were missing out on other things that other children take for granted. And that feeling of guilt really permeated and impacted their mental health, and the strain of not knowing how they were going to maybe put food on the table towards the end of the week. And just trying their best to mitigate the impact of the financial circumstances of their household on children. So going without themselves so that their children could have those things that are so key for childhood, like activities and going to school with even just the right materials to learn and everything like that. And I think it is a daily reality for so many people, so many children across Ireland. And you know, SVP has been here for 175 years, and a lot of the issues, although it's changed somewhat, there's still families who are cutting back on food, living in substandard housing, and having to deal with significant stress of just not having enough money to make ends meet.
Tricia, just like you've actually, you must be the record holder in appearances on the Reboot Republic podcast. I'd imagine at this stage it's between yourself and Michael Taft anyway, that's for sure.
And deservedly so, Tony.
Yeah, I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying it from that standpoint, you know, it's safe to say we've been talking about this for a while. And the last time you were up in the house, we were having a cup of coffee and we're chatting away. The world changed. COVID happened and everybody went into lockdown. And a lot of people, I think, got a taste for the first time of what some people were already lived experiences were like every day, feeling trapped, whether it was people with disabilities in substandard housing or people just in substandard housing. Has it exacerbated, has the coronavirus exacerbated things? And are there lessons in from the last few months that you think, because we know that there was a lot of stuff that we could do, what are the positives out of that, I suppose?
I think as you're talking about it, there is a sense that there is a way to do things differently now. People are having a critical reflection on the ability of markets to deliver key services, the value of caring work and essential work and low-paid work. I'm hopeful that we are going to do things differently this time, and I think there is a greater sense that there is a widespread inequality in Ireland. I think even just the basics, like the ability to do your schoolwork from home for children who maybe didn't have access to broadband or a digital device, or children who rely on school meals, and families who see that as some relief on their household budgets, that they know that the school lunch is taken care of. So I think there is a growing awareness of the issues and the difficulties people face, and there may be more solidarity in terms of how we deal with issues and how we emerge from this. Because if you address poverty and you do things like have a social welfare system that is adequate, that is accessible, that's comprehensive, if people have a secure, safe and affordable home to live in, if people can access good quality, affordable childcare, if people aren't experiencing energy poverty and they can afford to put the heating on, they're good things for everybody. It's not just for those who are struggling at the moment. And I hope there's a growing sense that we can do things differently. And I think there is a lot of positives in the programme for government. I suppose that's important to say. You know, there's a commitment to progressively realise a living wage for workers. And I think the value of low-paid workers and the contribution they make has really come to the fore in the last couple of weeks. There's also a commitment to end direct provision and move towards a not-for-profit international protection process. I suppose we would see firsthand the most extreme forms of poverty in DP, and it's very welcome that that issue has been taken on. There's also a commitment to examine socioeconomic status and include that in one of the grounds for discrimination in our equality legislation. And from a poverty point of view, that would be very significant, because people are discriminated because of where their postcode or their accent or where they've grown up or where they've gone to school. So including that would be a greater recognition of the difficulties and why poverty is something that does limit people's opportunities as well. So there is definitely a sense of doing things differently, and I hope that will prevail and we don't return to the old normal.
Let's not go back there.
I think that I would agree, in the sense that I think that, you know, no matter the COVID, absolutely, like it changed so much for people. And even if it was on a temporary basis, I think you're right, Tony, in terms of it opened people's eyes to, you know, what is the reality of being, as you say, locked at home or not being able to access things, or even not being able to do things the way you normally did. And many, you know, many tens of thousands of people lost their jobs and are not back at work, and some have no prospect of going back to work. And we're going to see an increase, you know, in people in poverty, already seeing it. And you know, we look at things like the ban on evictions that was introduced. We look at, you know, measures that the COVID payment itself and the debate around it, you know, what is actually a decent living, do you mean, welfare payment, for example? What is, you know, the ideas of a basic income? There's a lot to be taken out of this. And what is really important is that we do actually reflect on it and people continue to push for and make the case for, you know, dealing with poverty. And the idea, you know, why should we have poverty? Can't we eliminate poverty?
Is that a question? Of course.
Like, because it's something that, like, we always say, oh, we want to reduce this and it should be reduced to that. And it was a bit like the homeless thing going, no, why don't we want to end it? Why can't we end homelessness? Why can't we end poverty? We can.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I suppose what we would be saying is that we want a society where everybody can afford to meet a minimum essential standard of living. So whether that is through increasing social welfare rates or reducing the cost of living so everybody has access to decent quality services. And I think the discussion around the COVID payment really shone a light on the inadequacy of social welfare. And that's something that we've campaigned on for many years now. And I suppose that is actually missing from the programme for government. There is no commitment to benchmark social welfare rates. So if you don't at least index link social welfare rates, poverty, the gap between those on average incomes and low incomes opens up and poverty rates will increase as a result. So I think absolutely we can eliminate it. We need to use a lot of different measures. I suppose, you know, how many people have to rely on SVP to meet basic needs, how many people have to rely on money lenders to take out loans to pay for a utility bill, or if they're struggling to pay for school costs. You know, you want to see those kind of figures are also indicative of the level of difficulty people face. So I think we need to have a discussion on the adequacy of social welfare, and there is commitment to establish a commission on taxation and welfare, and I think that's long overdue.
Can I, and again, Trish, I don't expect you to comment on this, but I just wanted to say it's been something that's been itching at me for a while. When are we going to get to the point where in Ireland we can admit that the people who say, you know, we're looking at tax breaks, and in this program for government, they're looking at tax breaks for people on over €100,000. And then they say, but we're going to protect core social welfare payments. That has become the dog whistle of all dog whistles for poverty. That, you know, but we kept you at 186, or we kept you at 120, or we kept protect core. It's become this thing where it's used as a shield to neglect away from what actually is going on. And I think the sooner, as a society, we have an honest discussion about that, the better, because I'm sick of people getting away with saying things that are societally and economically, ruinous, and then getting away with it by finishing the sentence by saying "and protect core social welfare rates" as if that forgives everything else. Sorry.
No, I think you're right to raise that, Tony, because I think if I remember correctly, that started with the Labour and Fine Gael government. They started that around the austerity cuts and saying, well, at least we protected the core such and such benefits, even though they basically cut loan parent supports, cut so many other welfare supports that push people into poverty, but made this case, as you say, which is a completely, yes, it's true, you protected the core payments, but you also cut all these other payments. And also, as Tricia makes the point, that as the cost of living increase substantially, as other people's incomes go up, then unless you benchmark those costs of welfare, people fall further and further behind. And that is a big issue in Ireland, that the inequality economists, or should I call them I don't know what we'll call them anyway, the inequality defenders, they don't talk about the huge cost of living in Ireland, and how that, yes, we may have, you know, Ireland does this huge work on redistributing income through tax that makes our income, take-home income system more equal. But that doesn't then take in, as the point you've made, Tricia, around the cost of living that people face and the lack of public services that people are facing as well, and trying to deal in that poverty around it. But Tricia, in terms of St. Vincent de Paul, you mentioned there the numbers, and you've talked to us before about that, but I'm always quite struck about, you don't happen to have the numbers that you are working with, that you do provide support to?
Yeah, so the latest calls, we had about 15,000 calls in March to our local offices, but on average we have about 160,000 requests for assistance every year. And that really hasn't gone down in the last number of years since so-called recovery has happened. And I think we've spoken about this before. A lot of that is just the inadequacy of social welfare payments and the persistence of that, and people struggling to make ends meet. I suppose at the moment, our information officers are very busy at the moment because school costs, even though we are in COVID, parents are still getting requests for book lists or digital devices or voluntary contributions. And that issue has continues to persist, and there hasn't really been the level of action needed on that. We're also, I think, for the most part, the measures introduced during COVID have mitigated the worst impacts on people, because we have a moratorium on disconnections for utilities, we have an eviction ban, and the COVID payment has helped people just keep their head above water for now. But if the moratorium on disconnections, utility disconnections, is lifted, which is due to on Monday, and we're continuing to work with the regulator on that just to ensure that there's protections. If people have rent arrears, if the eviction ban is lifted, and there is a tapering of the pandemic support payments, we're going to see a significant increase in calls unless those measures are extended out. And I think we need to be looking at calling on the eviction ban to be extended out as long as possible until we stem the tide of people into homelessness. And you've already seen the impact of that. I think entry into homelessness has already declined by about 50%. And, you know, those measures are working. So people will be in significant amount of difficulty once those bills are piling up, and if their income is reduced and they've no prospect of going back to work. So we need to have a good discussion on that as well.
Well, I think we'll definitely have you back to see, you know, what does happen over the next couple of months. I think it's going to be really important to monitor that. And as you say, like indicators, you know, like broad indicators of even poverty levels and that come out once a year, don't pick up what you're picking up, do you know what I mean, in terms of that, the impact. So it would be great to get you back on in a month or two and just see where what is happening around that. And particularly, you're absolutely right, those measures need to be extended, particularly around the evictions, and there's going to be something needed in terms of rent arrears as well, definitely with people and some sort of work and support needed on that. But Tricia, listen, thanks so much for joining us. That was really, really, really good and really useful.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Listen, guys, just for listeners, there will be, the results will be known tomorrow on the Programme for Government. The Greens will have their votes in, Fianna Fáil will have their votes in, Fine Gael will have their votes in, and we'll be doing a live webinar for people who are members on Patreon, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Click in, we'll be opening up the mics, you can have a chat, and we will see what the situation is. Hoping to be joined by a few of the people involved, and we'll just see where it goes. In the meantime, I do think what one message I could take away from this is the emergency powers that they used to legislate during COVID that worked. I think 50% reduction of people, families going into homelessness, and we were told that they... Yeah, that's a phenomenal statistic, a phenomenal change. Thanks so much, Tricia. It's svp.ie, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, check out the work the guys do. The reports are there. And if you can, click the donate button. Talk to you all soon. Take care.